The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The answer to what Putin really wants is quite simple, and what he wants is to stay in power. He wants to stay in power another day, another week, another year, maybe another decade. But the longer that time horizon becomes, the more naturally fearful he becomes. One, because to stay in power that long, you need to exercise certain autocratic tactics, and he definitely has those tendencies kind of hardwired into him from his Soviet past, which then draws the attention of the U.S. and presidents like George W. Bush, who is all about democracy promotion abroad. That's the thing, is he doesn't differentiate necessarily between Trump and Obama and George W. Bush. He's on his third American president, and he sees a continuum of American foreign policy, which is about promoting American values abroad, which to him is just a Trojan horse for hard American power abroad.
I'm Alina Polyakova, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 9th, 2018. In this installment of the special series on Russia, I talk to Julia Yoffe of The Atlantic magazine. Julia is a journalist covering politics and world affairs, and most importantly for us, a longtime Russia watcher. Julia has a new article in the January-February issue of The Atlantic on what Putin really wants, fears, and what young Russians think of our obsession with their country. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Julia Yoffe on what Putin really wants and fears. Julia, welcome to the Lawfare Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So Julia, I'm really excited that you agreed to do this. One, because you're one of, I think, the smartest watchers, observers, analysts of Russia today.
Can your listeners hear me flipping my hair?
I think the whole world can just heard that. But no, I mean, in a serious way, I think at a time when there's so much being written on this topic, on this country, on its president, it's not easy to find, I think, objective, rational voices. So thank you for joining us and sharing your objective, rational voice with us.
Thank you.
So you have a great article out in the current issue of The Atlantic called What Putin Really Wants. It's a long read, but very well worth it. It really runs the gamut of talking about the 2016 election hacks and then who Putin really is as a person, what life is actually like in Russia, and what Russians think of our conversations about the hack. But before I get there, for our listeners who may not read you all the time on The Atlantic and everywhere else you've written over the years, you've been a Russia watcher, observer for a long time. You know, what keeps you interested in this place? Why do you keep coming back to it? What do you find exciting about it?
Well, first of all, thank you for all those kind words, and thank you for having me on this podcast. As to your question, I think there are two different answers. The thing that keeps me coming back to the subject of Russia is generally the fact that Vladimir Putin has, for the last five or so years, been doing crazy stuff.
Right.
At home, in the near abroad, in the more distant abroad, like Syria or the U.S. or the Spanish elections. And that's where the American demand comes in. And that tends to be pretty simplistic. And it's all about psychoanalyzing Putin and what he thinks and what he wants. what keeps me coming back is Russia's own strange, absurd, cyclical narrative that tends to not interest Americans all that much. They're, I would say Americans and American readers and viewers and consumers of this kind of news are very much part of the cult of personality that has developed around Vladimir Putin.
That's right. We'll talk a little bit about that, I think, going on. You know, you mentioned this term, the cyclical narrative. What do you mean by that exactly?
So the historian Jeffrey Hosking put it much better than I ever could, which is that Russia, especially in the last 100 or so years, you know, last year was 100th anniversary of the two revolutions of 1917. First, the abdication of the Tsar, and then the Bolshevik Revolution in the fall. And as Hosking put it, Russia tends to cycle from extreme to extreme, recreating the same thing over and over again in between, which is what I find the most interesting, is that from the outside, it looks like Russia's constantly changing. It's always on the cusp of major change, but actually it's just the kind of base elements are always there, always the same. It's just the clothing changes.
I think I'll paraphrase one quote that jumped out at me from the article, where I think you said something like that it was so typically Putin and so typically Russian to try to respond, and you're talking about the Russian influence operation in the United States in this instance, to try to respond in an overly aggressive way to try to cover up weakness. Is that what you're really talking about here? This kind of tendency that's been repeating itself in Russian history and is currently repeating itself now to perhaps overcompensate for a certain weakness or anxiety about itself, and this is being manifested through Putin today?
Oh, absolutely. I think that whenever something like this happens, and by something like this, I mean something that Putin does that makes Americans sit up and notice and ask, what is this guy doing? What does he want? What does he think? It's always seen as a vacuum, as opposed to as part of a larger chain of events. So just looking at the election interference, you have to think about, you know, what happened in the 5 years leading up to it. So let's go back to, you know, 2014 and the Sochi Olympics. So that's what, 2 years. Putin is riding high on Sochi. He, you know, his athletes did well there. It basically went off without a hitch. He showed that Russia had arrived on the international stage. And he goes in and invades Ukraine and lops off and annexes part of its territory, meaning Crimea. And he is suddenly punished for it. And I don't think he expects to be punished for it the way he is. He is suddenly in the doghouse. He's banned from the G8, which I didn't mention in the article, but he apparently found this more galling than the sanctions. So because he's in the outhouse, he craves sitting at the big boys table, the table with the, you know, world superpowers, he's trying to claw his way back in, into the house, to the big table. So what does he do? He keeps harping on counterterrorism. In the meantime, ISIS is rising. It's attacking cities in Europe, places in the U.S., and Putin's saying, look, we're fighting the same people.
And look, he's been saying this ever since 9/11, basically.
That's right. But he really, you know, this was his favorite card to play. He played it again, and he went into Syria and said, look, we're fighting ISIS in a way that you're not, which wasn't true. But it was his gambit to come in from the cold. And he almost accomplished that. And then he went and met, you know, riding high on that, he went and meddled in the 2016 election. So he tends to overplay his hand, then not anticipate the blowback that his adventures generate. And then he gets very upset and lashes out again. So it's this, I think people in the U.S. see him as a very deeply strategic, long-term planner, thinker, somebody who's detail-oriented, who is this chess master who has calculated each possible move and 10 moves ahead, which is not true. He's a very emotional decision maker, a very knee-jerk, reactive decision maker. And part of this idea about responding to weakness with aggression Domestically, he does similar things, and sometimes it takes this weird inverted form. Mm. So if he's facing a lot of pressure at home to do something, he will, as a rule, not do it until the limelight has moved on. And then a few months later, he'll do the thing that people were pressing on him to do, but just so that it looks like he did it on his terms, that he wasn't pushed into anything.
So he's not succumbing to pressure.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about Putin, because he does come out, you know, as a character in your story almost. But I think the story has many more characters besides Putin, which is also important to note. You know, the title of the story is What Putin Really Wants. I don't know if you wrote that headline or not.
I did not.
I'm guessing not. But what struck me as I read through the article is a lot of it, what you're explaining there, is not actually what Putin wants, is what he fears, mm-hmm. Which I thought was really interesting. And then those fears tend to drive his actions and activities in this very emotional way. I think this is something that's also, I think, very prominent in your writing here and elsewhere, that there's this tendency, as you said, to think of Putin as a very rational actor who's cool and collected under pressure. But in fact, this image of him acting out of emotion in somewhat kind of erratic ways is becoming more and more clear, I think, through your writing and through some of the people who've been watching Russia and who get what's happening there. But to go back to this question of fear, I mean, you know, you point to a few things that Putin is most afraid of. Do you want to talk about those things for a second? Like, what really drives those emotional responses for him?
Well, I think the answer to what Putin really wants is quite simple. And what he wants is to stay in power. He wants to stay in power another day, another week, another year, maybe another decade. But the longer that time horizon becomes, the more naturally fearful he becomes. One, because to stay in power that long, you need to exercise certain autocratic tactics. And he definitely has those tendencies kind of hardwired into him from his Soviet past, which then draws the attention of the U.S. and presidents like George W. Bush, who was all about democracy promotion abroad. That's the thing, is Putin's also reacting. He doesn't differentiate necessarily between Trump and Obama and George W. Bush. He's on his third American president, and he sees a continuum of American foreign policy, which is about promoting American values abroad, which to him is just a Trojan horse for hard American That's power right. abroad. And he thinks that he is on the target list after Muammar Gaddafi, Hosni Mubarak, Saddam Hussein, Bashar al-Assad, that America doesn't like dealing with dictators. It likes democratically elected leaders, and that they're trying to topple him. He's not totally wrong. If you hear a lot of the conversations in Washington, people would love to see Vladimir Putin out of power. The problem is in a country like Russia, which is the heir to the Byzantine Empire, there's never really a peaceful transition right. of power. His transition into power was exceptional. He got power because he was able to guarantee to Boris Yeltsin, his predecessor, that he would guarantee not only safety to him and his family, but a lack of prosecution for the unbelievable corruption that family, known actually as the family, perpetrated. And it seems like he's having trouble finding that successor for himself. For a while, it was Dmitry Medvedev, and we saw a bit of a thaw inside Russia and in Russia's relation to the U.S. and the West from 2009 to 2012, 2008 to 2012. But he failed that test. Medvedev failed that test. He allowed the NATO invasion of Libya and the toppling Muammar Gaddafi. And Putin, I think, realized that he, you know, was, do I have to do everything myself around here? And I think the answer for him was yes. But he's a mortal man. And it's not clear that he has an exit strategy. It seems from the conversations I heard in Moscow and now coming out of Moscow that he's looking for an exit strategy, because he will one day die, or he will one day become enfeebled. And he also thinks about his legacy, and he thinks of himself as a historically important leader up there with Stalin and Peter the Great, you know, of Russia. So he wants to pass on something that won't immediately fall apart. But the longer he's in power, the more likely it is that it will just fall apart the second he dies.
Exactly. So in a way, you know, his greatest fear is that Russia will take the path of Ukraine, for example. There's a popular uprising and the regime leader is toppled, or the Libya example, mm-hmm. where there's intervention from the United States or other Western powers that takes down an authoritarian regime.
In a very humiliating, bloody way. If you remember how Muammar Gaddafi was killed, mm-hmm. you know, he was pulled from the gutter, excuse me, you know, with just his handgun, you know, the Lion of North Africa, was basically lynched on camera. And Vladimir Putin watched that video on repeat, the same way that he watched the trial and execution of Saddam Hussein on repeat. You can tell he deeply, personally identifies with these men, and that fear of meeting a similar end, which is what the intervention in Syria was about. It is not at all about ISIS. It is not at all about counterterrorism. It is about saying Washington cannot say Bashar al-Assad must go, or Muammar Gaddafi must go, or Vladimir Putin must go.
That's right. So if you're sitting in the Kremlin, you're looking out into the world, and you see the Arab Spring, and then you see the fall of Yanukovych, Ukraine's former president, who was toppled in the Maidan Revolution.
And before that, the color revolutions.
Right. And you see from Moscow perspective, the West, specifically the United States, hand in all of these matters, mm-hmm. and even more specifically, Hillary Clinton's hand in many of these popular uprisings.
Plus, this is somebody who does not believe. Vladimir Putin, like many people who have served in the KGB and the FSB, is deeply conspirological. And he does not believe in organic uprisings.
Right.
There has to be a shadowy hand there. There have to be payments there. The people coming out into the streets aren't lobbying for a better future for themselves or a more transparent, honest political system. They are necessarily paid for and agitating for the interests of a foreign power. They are necessarily a fifth column, and that they are the kind of the Trojan horse in which, you know, an American army comes in and topples him.
Right. There's this profound cynicism,
yes.
or almost inability to believe that there can be an authentic, organic people's movement, democratic move, because in a way, individuals don't really matter. They don't really exist from the Russian point of view. It's all about the state and the institutions of the state. And I mean, that makes a lot of sense if you look at Russian history, of course.
And also at what, you know, the KGB did. The KGB sponsored, this came to light recently, sponsored protests outside the American embassy in India in the 70s. You know, they did similar things, and they assume, the way that the U.S. assumes this about other countries, that it's done the same way everywhere else. And the same way that Americans don't understand the depth of Russian cynicism, not just in Vladimir Putin and those around him, but all the way down. Russians don't understand American idealism and naivete and optimism. They think it's cynical.
Or they think it's a veil or a facade for somebody's true intentions, which are much more pernicious or malicious.
Right. So my favorite example of this was during the protests, the kind of pro-democracy, anti-Putin protests in the winter of 2011-2012.
Following the elections that were riddled with fraudulent interventions.
Mm-hmm. And this also was happening a year after the Arab Spring. So very troubling for the Kremlin. And I remember at the first really big protest right near the Kremlin, walking around, and I see this young man wearing a scarf with gold, yellow, black, and white, which are the kind of nationalist colors of Russia, which seemed out of place there. I started talking to him, and I asked him, you know, what are you doing here? And he's like, oh, well, he was probably like 18, 19. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I'm here because my friends are here. They all wanted to come and participate. And at the time, the Russian state TV was already saying that Hillary Clinton, because Putin said that Hillary Clinton had given kind of the signal for these protesters to come out, and state TV had taken this message and run with it and said all these protesters were paid for by the State Department, which if you have ever encountered the State Department and its budget, and budgetary woes, you would realize is comical. But the same way we think Russia is omnipotent, Russians think the State Department is omnipotent and well-funded. So I said, well, you know your friends. Do you think they were paid by the State Department to be here? And he said, well, they deny it, but I'm sure they are. And I said, why do you think that? And he's like, well, I'm paid to be here by NACHI, which is the pro-Kremlin youth organization. So they must be paid too. They're not just going to come out and spend their free time for free. So, and I, to me, that is the kind of the microcosmic encapsulation of what's happening at the very tops.
Exactly. So there's no sense of ideology or values, I think, inherent in the Kremlin today. I think this is a really interesting point.
It's cynical kind of utilitarianism, right? Putin has, another thing that Americans don't understand about him is he's not ideological. He just never has been, and never, he is the quintessence of that last Soviet generation, which is deeply, deeply cynical and believes that all ideology is just a tool in the service of power, state power. And so he goes through ideologies like I go through gloves in the winter or umbrellas in the fall. You know, it's whatever works, whatever, you know, I lose one, I get more. So conservative Christian values were his ruling ideology in the first couple years of his third term, because he needed something to legitimize an illegitimate return to power. Then it was about the Russian world, starting with Ukraine, so that Russia is more than a country with borders. Mm-hmm. It's an idea. And we'll see what it's going to be in his fourth term.
Well, we'll come back to that. You know, I think the point that you made earlier in our conversation, and the others have also made, I think, is still deeply profound, that if there is a logic or an ideology to the regime, it's the regime for the sake of the regime, right? It is the stability for the sake of stability, Putin for the sake of Putin, right? And there's really nothing beyond that. And it's sort of, I would imagine if you're a young person in Russia today, that probably feels very empty to you. I mean, at least, you know, deeply problematic the communist system was, at least in the very early days, there was a vision for the future. And right now, it seems like there's no vision for the future that the Kremlin is able to propose, that Putin himself is able to propose, except that it's just regime for the sake of the regime in itself. So I want to talk about the example you brought up with this 18-year-old that you spoke with, to kind of talk about the young people in Russia today. I think there's been this ongoing debate about whether Russia's youth are going to be the engine of some sort of change. We saw that in the most recent demonstrations of last year, that Alexei Navalny, Russia's main and best-known opposition leader, calls for these protests, anti-corruption protests, and we see lots of young people come out across the country, outside of Moscow, outside of St. Petersburg, in a pretty unprecedented way, I think, under Putin. What do you think about this notion that, you know, the young people of Russia are going to be, you know, more democratically, more Western-minded, they're going to want all those freedoms, and then that they're going to go to the streets and protest for those freedoms?
So this is another, it's an excellent question. It's another, one of America's favorite myths that I find deeply, deeply problematic, because it doesn't really survive contact with reality. And we see this not just in Russia, but in other places, because young people, especially young men who have little to lose and have, let's say, unrealistic perceptions of risk and consequence, come out, face down tanks, etc. Young people have a way of getting older and becoming more pragmatic and more scared, because they have more to lose. They start becoming fathers and husbands or mothers and wives. They might get mortgages and cars and jobs that they could easily lose. And then suddenly they're middle-aged and they haven't affected any change and won't. And so there's always a very small window. The thing is that look, for example, at the young people who came out and helped topple the Soviet Union. And you can ask former American ambassador to Moscow, Michael McFaul, about these people who wrote about them extensively. He was a graduate student in, you know, writing his dissertation in Moscow at the time, and spent a lot of time with these young liberals who were, you know, out there crusading for change and Western values and democracy and a free press and human rights, etc. If they're not dead now, a lot of them have sold out, have really embraced the most militant, jingoistic, nationalistic parts of Putin's agenda, either because they were bought off and they, you know, your tastes become more expensive with time, or because they really believe in it because they were so disillusioned by the 90s. You know, young people don't stay young forever, and their ideology is not fixed. And, you know, even now, the people who came out in 2011, 2012, which was only, you know, 6 years ago, It's nothing. They are not really coming out for Navalny. They are scared. They learned the lesson that the state wanted them to learn, which was all it took was, you know, 36 arrests and prison sentences that weren't very long, actually. I mean, they're long if you're the person sitting in jail for 3 years in a, you know, in a Russian penal colony. But in the grand scheme of things, if you really are a freedom fighter, seeing 36 people go to jail for 2 to 3 years is, you know, not a huge price to pay, right? Nobody got killed.
Right. That was interesting. The reaction of the state to those protests from last year, or for, I guess, 2016 now, I'm still in 2017 in my mind, was not as repressive and oppressive as it could have been.
It was very late Soviet. You know, you just needed a couple examples. And so the state was very strategic in whom it punished. So made sure to get a socialist, a nationalist, an anarchist, somebody who for whom it was their first time protesting, somebody who was a longtime protester, somebody who was young, somebody who was old, like a pensioner. And it was just so that each part of the kind of opposition coalition could see themselves in one of these victims of a political case. And people learned their lesson very quickly. A lot of journalists left the media. The people who were teenagers at that time and were very impressed by the sight of tens of thousands of people protesting in Moscow told me, you know, I saw that not only will you not change anything, but you can get in massive trouble and have your life ruined. So I don't even read about politics. I don't even read the news anymore. I don't want to go anywhere near it. I just want to live my life. And so now you have, the young man is a barometer on the street. Another young man I encountered, two young men I encountered back in March at the first big Navalny protest in Moscow. It was two kids. They were, one was 14, one was 16, had little, you know, whiskers coming in. And I asked them if they remembered those protests and if they remembered the punishments that were meted out. And one of them said, oh, yeah, that was in February 1917, right? And the other one goes, you idiot. No, it was October 1917. And it might as well have been 1917 to them. They hadn't learned that lesson, right? Because they were too young and it wasn't on national TV. But now the state is teaching this generation that lesson too. You know, thousands of arrests, and a lot of them will turn into real prison time. Yes. So like, I think people are not fearless. And we're seeing that now, by the way, here in the U.S. with this kind of the anti-Trump sentiment. You see very quickly how quickly people, where their limits are. And it's usually their job, their mortgage, their, you know, people aren't willing to risk everything, even here in this, you know, the kind of ground zero of democratic ideals.
That's right. And, you know, there's also been some other interviews that have been done with Russia's youth, people ages 15 to 24. You've done a lot of these interviews yourself as well. That showed that actually many of these people are really true believers in Putinism. So it's not even that they're not willing to take the risk. They actually really love Putin and contribute to that, you know, 80-something approval rating that he consistently gets.
It's hard to tell with the approval rating, as it's a whole other can of worms. But according to the sociological work that has been done, that group of 18 to 24-year-olds is the most patriotic, jingoistic generation. It's
Putin's generation.
Right. And there's a lot that goes into that. In part, I'm sure there's a big amount of cynicism leavening that, right? They know what the right thing to say is so as to not get in trouble and to not risk their car, their mortgage, their job, etc. The other thing I wanted to say, the little bits of reporting about the election hack that have been coming out of Russia have shown us some very interesting things about Russian youth. So TV Rain, the last independent Russian television station network, interviewed this guy they called Maxim, who was one of the trolls in the infamous troll factory in St. Petersburg. Mm-hmm. And what he said was fascinating and directly kind of cuts it to the heart of this myth of the, you know, youth in the streets. Most of the people in that factory were students at St. Petersburg State University, the number two university in the country. Prestigious, in Russia's second city, very European city, very cosmopolitan. They were generally students in international politics, journalism, linguistics, and Middle East history. So kind of the elite of the humanities. Mm-hmm. And they were there, you know, trolling our comment sections, Twitter, Facebook, spreading Putin's message, because they were receiving twice the average Russian salary. They were more than happy to do Putin's dirty work for him instead of being out on the streets protesting for his demise.
There's a story in the article that's in the January, February issue of The Atlantic that we've been talking about, your article, where you describe this other young student, I think his name is Sergei, if I'm not mistaken, who is one of the kind of elite hackers, yeah. Computer science, IT guys, who seems to at some point, you know, be very cynical about the regime. Mm-hmm. And I think then you ask him, you know, do you want to go work for the FSB? Or he says, anywhere, whoever pays me better, I'll go work for the, you know, French intelligence services, you know, yep. Whoever. You know, and it comes out that the people you end up talking to in this kind of elite cohort of young people who are being trained to be the next tech generation of Russia, that, you know, again, it's just like their reflection of the regime, they're non-ideological. And they're really being driven by, I think, what are, you know, common human concerns about survival, you know, making a living, having a decent life, not having, not needing to constantly be of want and of need.
And I think that's especially pertinent in Russia, where the 90s are still pretty fresh in people's memories, especially for young people who saw their parents fall into poverty, who saw their parents stop being teachers and engineers and become smugglers of clothes from Turkey or China. And as they see now more and more of their countrymen slip further and further into poverty as the economy continues to founder. So, you know, Russian poverty rates are still climbing up and the ruble is still low and quality of life is still pretty low everywhere. And so if you're surrounded by that, it's natural to want to just get out of there and to have a nicer life than the people around you.
Yeah, this reminds me of one of my favorite Bertolt Brecht sayings, right? From, I think, the Three Penny Opera, that first comes the stomach and then comes morality, right? So as long as people are mostly concerned about these kinds of questions.
And this is actually, that's an excellent point. And this is very much the center of political debate in Russia and has been, yes, for a long time. And the way Russians will put it is, what's going to win, the fridge or the television? Right. Meaning, and this again became a subject of discussion in 2014 when the television was telling them, never mind that everything in your fridge has just become far more expensive than you were used to. Look, we got Crimea, we got recognition abroad as a world superpower. That's more important, and you should be willing to pay more for your sausage and your eggs and your bread for that luxury. And the question was always, how, to what extent would that balance work? And to what extent would Russians be willing to pay for the jingoism and nationalism coming out of their TV screens? And so far, they've been willing.
Right. Well, it seems to me that I kinda, you know, want to hear your thoughts since you start talking a little bit about what the succession question in Russia. I mean, this is the question for all authoritarian personalist regimes that they have to reckon with at some point. You know, what comes after dear leader? And, you know, it seems that for Putin, and you talked a little bit about the themes of his presidency and his time in power since 2000, that the initial social contract seemed to be, you know, you give up some political rights, but here's economic prosperity. Mm-hmm. And that worked for a while the oil prices were high. Then, of course, oil prices collapse. And then, you know, in his most recent term, the social contract seems to have shifted to, well, now we have economic stagnation, you know, prices on everyday goods are going up. So we can't promise you economic prosperity. But look, I've made Russia great again.
And we plundered your pension fund to pay for Sochi.
Exactly. You know, but look, Russia's a great power again. Russia's at the table. Russia's not on its knees anymore, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the question is that likely going to be the theme that continues to work in Russia? I mean, you just made the point that so far it seems to be working, right? That there is this economic decline, but, you know, the Russians don't seem to really care that much. Although there's been a few tensions, like mm-hmm. the long-haul truckers' protest that was ongoing for about 2 years, but that doesn't seem to have actually moved anything at the political level. But we're seeing a few things, but pretty minor tensions in the country. So I guess my question is, you know, the elections are happening in Russia in just a few months, in March. I think
who do you think's going to win?
Right, I have no idea who's going to win. Maybe Ksenia Sobchak. I think we all know who's going to win those elections, and Putin will be 71, 72 by the end of this next term. Mm-hmm. You know, how is he going to, I think, what do you think will define this upcoming term in power for him?
I think that's the big question. And I think the people around him in the Kremlin are looking for it. Then you see on, you know, from the outside the Kremlin walls, people like Navalny, who is saying, actually, the things you're giving up are paying not for Crimea and for Syria. They're paying for Medvedev's dacha. They're paying for the defense minister's luxurious mansions, for the patriarch of the church's resort on the Black Sea, and inserting this, you know, calling attention to this very real, very surreal corruption in Russia. Because these things like the truckers' protest, they've been sporadic throughout Putin's presidency, and the Kremlin is generally very worried about those things because those protesters will always say, we're not political, we just don't.
Exactly.
It's just about this one economic pressure. But the thing is about those things are going to become more and more frequent because the pie continues to shrink, mm-hmm. whereas the appetites at the very top do not. And so the truckers were protesting because two of Putin's friends decided to squeeze some money out of truckers by taxing them, right? Some other parts of the government are trying to squeeze money out of pensioners who have inherited apartments in very expensive parts of big Russian cities. So taxing them on money they don't have, right? Just trying to squeeze more and more money out of the population to feed their appetites, which is a story we've seen, and we saw it mm-hmm. happen about 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the problem with that is that at some point they're going to squeeze a little too hard, and the opposition that comes up to counter that will not be, you know, the bourgeois white collar liberals that we saw come out 6 years ago. It'll be a much more populist protest, which is what you're seeing with Navalny. And so, that's a little scarier.
Yeah. Let's talk about Navalny for just a second. You know, he's somebody who I think in the West has become very well known as the opposition figure in Russia today that could pose a serious challenge to Putin. And I know we have to take any sort of polling in Russia with some skepticism, but it seems clear that Putin is genuinely popular, maybe not 86% popular, but the majority of Russians probably still vote for him because, you know, he's the czar. Everybody else might be corrupt, but he's the czar.
Right, and he's also there's also no alternatives to him, and there haven't been any alternatives to him for about two decades. So people can't even imagine Russia not led by Putin, which also traps Putin and sets up a problem for his successor.
So what's fascinating to me, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, is, you know, Navalny has been barred from competing in the presidential elections on trumped up political charges for embezzlement. This just happened recently. He expected it. I think everybody expected it. it is interesting to me that the regime, the Kremlin, will not even let Navalny compete, even though Putin will still likely win handsomely. So why do you think that is? Is it this anxiety that, you know, if we let this person actually compete, there might be some unexpected result where he gets 15% of the vote versus 5% that the polls project? Or, you know, what is it that is makes the regime so anxious even about letting somebody who likely will not be a real contender for the presidency run?
So I think that's one of the concerns, is that he, you know, he already has done that once in the Moscow mayoral elections of 2013. He, from what I heard, the numbers were fudged in the end to not force a runoff. But he apparently, according to like the raw math, he had gotten to the point where he was forcing the incumbent Kremlin appointed mayor of Moscow into a runoff, which is unacceptable. Imagine if Navalny loses, but comes close to forcing Putin into a runoff. The father of a nation does not go to runoffs. He won't even get that close. But even allowing him to participate, A, grants him legitimacy. B, allows him airtime on Russia's federal state-controlled channels.
Which he currently doesn't have.
Which he is blacklisted from, and which also keeps his recognizability, I'm losing my English here, pretty low, right? Because there's no other national media that he has access to other than YouTube. And it allows the Kremlin to control the image of him that's out there. So if people recognize Navalny, they generally know him from the coverage of his trials for embezzlement and fraud and whatever. So it allows them to delegitimize him. And the other thing is that if he were really running against Putin and he had access to these media platforms, it would just be a big PR headache for the Kremlin, just a lot of unpleasant. I had a former Kremlin insider still kind of proximate to those circles telling me, like, look, Putin would be turning on the TV every day and there's, you know, like unpleasant things being said about him every day. It's like, not that it matters. He's just like a small dog yapping and biting at your ankles. It's still unpleasant. You want to avoid that. And as much as Putin takes huge risks abroad, he still has this KGB mindset of make sure there is no risk, actually, especially in these domestic political operations.
That's really interesting.
And what I think is interesting is that Navalny actually is the person that we think Putin is. He is the one who is extremely detail-oriented, extremely strategic, thinks in very long time horizons. I profiled him back in 2011, 2012, and he is very slow, very meticulous, very patient with how he has built his political image, his political career. He knew always that he was never going to be allowed on the ballot this time. And he went at great personal expense, including to his person. You know, he had a chemical burn in his eye from somebody who splashed chemicals on his face, opened dozens and dozens of election offices across Russia, drawing protests, drawing arrests, drawing beatings. He's gearing up for something else. He knew he would never run in 2018, but he is much younger than Putin. And I think Ksenia Sobchak also, I think they're practicing for something else, for a post-Putin future.
Post-2024.
Well, may we all still be alive.
Indeed. Who knows these days? Julie, we should wrap up. But before we go, you know, I wanted to ask you about what you're reading these days. Doesn't have to be Russia, but I thought maybe if there are things you're reading to get Russian news in English that you think more people should read of, where do you get those news? And is there a particularly good book that you're into right now?
Well, in terms of books, I basically only read novels. I think the writing is much better and it informs how I write, so I'll spare you that. In terms of Russian news in English, there are actually two phenomenal newish resources, both started by the editors and editorial staff of very well-known internet publications that were driven out by media owners who felt pressure from the Kremlin. One is called Medusa. It is based out of Riga in Latvia, so out of reach of the Kremlin's long arm, spelled M-E-D-U-Z-A.
.io.
.io, and they have an English site, and they have an English daily newsletter that is excellent, and I read it every day. The other is a much newer publication called The Bell, also .io, that's run out of San Francisco. It is also excellent. They published, about a month ago, published a phenomenal and phenomenally detailed report by the best investigative journalist in Russia, Svetlana Rader, about the infighting between the FSB and the GRU, that this is how we found out that a Russian hack of the DNC even happened, because these two security agencies were battling for turf. That's right. And funding. And it's just such a well-done piece of journalism. And everything on their site is just really good. They also have a daily newsletter called The Daily Ringtone, I think. Also very good. And I think those, if you stick with those, you're pretty much set. And then there's, you know, great reporters work in English working out of Russia, at the AP, at the Guardian, at the New York Times. So,
yeah, I have to say the Russia correspondents I read for some of these major papers like the Times, Wall Street Journal, even the FT are really excellent. Mm-hmm. Right now, there's a really, I think, a talented generation of reporters who are reporting out of Moscow today.
Pretty much all men, which is, I think, kind of a problem, but still very good.
Good point. Well, on that,
one thing that I will add that it's coming out in March, but that everybody has to see, and it's pertinent to our discussion, is Armando Iannucci's new film, The Death of Stalin. And it's about basically what happens the day that Dear Leader drops dead, and how is a successor determined, and does that successor ever have that kind of legitimacy that Dear Leader had? And it is weirdly hilarious.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. It's really good.
A comedy of sorts.
But like a very British comedy about the death of Stalin and the purges. And yeah, it's really good.
So I will look for that. I think our listeners after the description will also look for that. Julia, this has been a really fascinating conversation. Again, your article on The Atlantic, January, February edition, is absolutely fascinating read. I recommend it highly to everyone for just a dose of some rational thinking in this environment that's very hysterical about Russia today. Thank you for all your work, and thank you for writing about these topics. Thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to tweet the Lawfare podcast, share it on Facebook or the Telegram canal, and give it a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast distribution system you may use. Our music, as always, is performed by Sophia Yan. I'm Alina Polyakova. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.